This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Bill Gates wants to help solve a mystery. Why 5 million Americans have Alzheimer's, yet we know so little about the disease? Gates is investing $50 million of his money in this, but he says this is not about a cure.
Should the word cure be used with Alzheimer's?
It's probably setting a high bar. At first, we probably should say treatment. And any type of treatment would be a huge advance, you know, from where we are today. So, yes, I believe there's a solution.
Our next guest helps families and caregivers figure out what to do when their loved one has Alzheimer's or dementia. Erica Farrell, clinical manager at the Washington State chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You and Bill Gates are on the same page on this one. There's a lot we don't know. What are your biggest questions about Alzheimer's?
Yeah, that's right. There is quite a bit we don't know about the disease still. We don't exactly know what causes it. We don't know why it impacts certain people like African Americans and Latinos at a higher rate than Caucasian Americans or Caucasians overall. We don't know how to stop it. We don't know how to treat it.
How can that be? Are you surprised at how little we know?
I mean, sometimes, yes, actually. I mean, there's a lot of hope on the research end. Every research trial that, you know, we conduct, we learn more and more about the disease. You know, we talk a lot about the amyloid and tau proteins and the buildup and impact that they have and kind of mimicking the symptoms, the progression of those mimicking the symptoms of the disease. But, you know, there's a lot more I'd like to know personally. I think a lot of families would like to know, too.
What is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia?
So dementia is actually an umbrella term that we use to describe a specific set of symptoms, and Alzheimer's is a type of dementia. So there are many different types of dementia.
So why don't we just talk about dementia? Why does Alzheimer's get so much of the attention?
Yeah, because it is people are diagnosed with Alzheimer's at a higher rate than the others. So it's the most prominent type of dementia out there right now.
Yeah. How does it work? How does Alzheimer's work?
Well, what we know is that there is a buildup of tau proteins and amyloid proteins in the brain. And we know this kind of after death, right? We look at autopsies of the brain. And basically what happens is they interrupt communication between brain cells. And I'm definitely watering this down quite a bit.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah. So they disrupt communication between brain cells, which does lead to cell death. And that's when we start to see some symptoms of, you know, the typical symptoms with memory loss and difficulty processing information, difficulty with familiar tasks, familiar places, not being able to recognize those.
So the memory loss is just a symptom of the cell death?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's impacting the communication between the brain cells that impact how, you know, the ability to speak, the ability to grab words from your brain. Essentially, it's because the brain is dying.
Yeah.
You know, that starts to happen.
By the way, I want to say out front that my mother has not been diagnosed with anything, but mm-hmm. she's in a senior living center, and she's clearly losing her memory, getting shorter and shorter. And so I relate to this kind of stuff personally. Do you think it's important that we get some kind of, I know you don't know me or my mom, but huh. but should more people go and try to get a diagnosis than actually do?
Yeah, absolutely. We really recommend diagnosis because it really helps the person with the disease as well as family members who might be living with them or helping them, caring for them, helps them plan for the future. So it's really a starting off point.
Why? How does the planning come in?
Yeah, so I'm glad you're asking these questions because it's actually, you know, questions that physicians themselves have. And that's why we also sometimes have trouble getting physicians to diagnose as early as possible because we think there's no cure. What can I possibly do if there's no cure? This is just going to play out. But the reality is there's a lot of things that we can put in place ahead of time to prepare the family and the person, you know, for what's to come. I mean, people move through this disease in a very individual way. I mean, there are some common themes, but, you know, generally having a plan in place that might involve, you know, respite care or housekeeping or meals. You know, maybe it's care planning for, you know, eventually moving into some kind of senior living facility where there's more support in place, or maybe it's staying at home.
Even though I don't know a progression rate, but it's mm-hmm. more like it just helps me picture some eventual possible outcomes.
Yeah, and helps you also educate yourself or work with somebody to, you know, around what are these changes going to look like and how can I best respond to the person with the disease? You know, what works and what doesn't? We definitely have a lot of tips for caregivers when it comes to that, you know, just communicating with the person.
I understand you had a grandparent who probably had Alzheimer's or progressive dementia. You never knew?
Exactly. I think it was kind of a case where, you know, never was diagnosed. We saw some symptoms ourselves and had questions, but, you know, she passed away before, you know, we really knew for sure. And now that I'm in this field in particular, I think that's probably what we were looking at.
Why? How would a diagnosis have changed things in your case?
I think we would have put more support in place earlier and had more more frequent contact with her. Excuse me. I think we sort of, and I think a lot of families do this, but you know, think, oh well, they're just getting older, and it's really easy. The warning signs are really easy to kind of say, oh, well, she's older now. But you know, the reality is once you kind of get past the warning signs into the disease, you know, people eventually need help with activities of daily living. You know, just to get through a day, they're going to need some assistance with different pieces. And so I think that, you know, as soon as someone gets a diagnosis, even if, I mean, hopefully it is when they're in the very early stages, they can be a part of that conversation, you know, what the future looks like and what they're going to be comfortable with. And, you know, talking with the people that they're caring for them about, the future in general and what that looks like.
We asked our listeners about this. I'd like to get some ideas from you about how we can deal with dementia and Alzheimer's as best we can. I'm talking with Erica Farrell, clinical manager at the Washington State chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and we are on Twitter at KUOW right now. First of all, I want to get your reaction, if any, to the Bill Gates investment, $50 million, and the attention that comes with Bill Gates. How did you react to that?
I was over the moon, so excited this morning.
Was it a surprise?
It was, for me personally, yes. I know that, you know, I think that he had been kind of in contact with, you know, leaders in our Chicago office and certainly our CEO out there. But it's so great because, like you said, he's bringing a huge awareness to this now. And certainly his dedication to funding, you know, more innovative studies, it's wonderful.
He seems quite selective about what he can choose his limited, you know, his sort of unlimited money, but limited time and attention.
Yeah.
And he says he has a history, whether it's family or friends, with dementia. And it sounds like it moved him on this. Did you notice anything about what he said?
I did read the blog article that mm-hmm. he posted. He mentioned, you know, family members, and I loved his points. We do need, I don't know. Sorry about this. I'm just really excited. I think I'm really excited to see what's to come.
So I mentioned we asked listeners what has worked for them, what's helped them find some moments of lightness, even comfort, as they care for someone with Alzheimer's. And Heather wrote, "I'm caring for my mother, and she's extremely depressed and angry over her situation. Her father and his sisters all suffered from the disease and used humor to get them through it. I was hoping my mother would take the same approach." Have you seen humor work with Alzheimer's patients?
I guess that's kind of a big question. I mean, in what way? I think humor, yeah, absolutely. I think we all need to find the lightness in this disease. I mean, some things can be very funny.
Memory loss, I mean, inherently can lead to funny situations if that's how you're looking at it.
Exactly. And I think it's important to keep that lens. You know, this disease isn't funny. There's a lot to be, you know, upset about and sad about and certainly depressed about. I think humor is a really an important thing to keep at heart, especially, you know, for a caregiver, family, the person with the disease as much as possible.
Yeah. Heather also said about her mother, it's very hard to try to support an unwilling recipient. Do you have any advice for talking to families, caregivers who might have somebody who's, you know, understandably they're depressed, they're angry, they're not easy to help?
Yeah. You know, it's not unusual that, you know, people initially very much deny what's happening, and are depressed and are hard to reach. And I think that, you know, how we might work with a caregiver, it's very individual. Heather, please call us. But I think that for the caregiver, trying to empathize as much as possible. So remembering that this person is facing, and meeting them where they're at, So, you know, if they're not ready to talk about Alzheimer's disease, you know, using mirroring language sometimes is helpful. Like, they might acknowledge memory loss, but they might not say, I have Alzheimer's disease or mm-hmm. kind of dementia. And so using, you know, mirroring those the language that they use and kind of trying to work with them at their own pace while, you know, still giving nudges and opportunities for social engagement, you know, connecting with other family or friends, you know, encouraging that as much as possible. But knowing at the end of the day, you know, they're able, still able to make their own decision. And if they're not going to do anything, that's not the caregiver's fault.
By the way, for what little it's worth, again, my mother doesn't have a diagnosis. She's clearly losing her memory. And I have been reluctant to bring that up because who wants to talk about that? And maybe she'll be bummed out or mad, alienated from me if I bring it up. But I honestly have so far haven't found that to be the case. And I was telling you about that and you said, well, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Maybe it's a relief.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I think that's very typical that caregivers or other friends or family who are noticing something might be afraid or hesitant to talk about it. But, you know, some people are so appreciative to have the space to say, you know what, something is going on and I'm afraid just like you are. And I think we should definitely give people the opportunity. So don't shy away from those conversations. Have them.
A couple more questions. We got a one-word answer from listener Andrew, and we asked about what gets you through. The answer, this one word, cannabis, which, of course, we don't know. Is that for Andrew or for presumably the person he's caring for? It just made me wonder, where does medical marijuana fit in with Alzheimer's patients?
Yeah, so the FDA, definitely, it's not a treatment approved by the FDA. And right at this moment, there really isn't enough research at all to determine whether it's helpful. So, you know, we wouldn't recommend it based on that. However, we are hopeful that we will have more information. You know, I think there have been a couple of small studies that we've funded to try to figure out, you know, is this helpful? Is there some legitimacy to people who do experience, you know, for the person with the disease, more clarity? Or, you know, we've heard some of this before from caregivers. But yeah, the bottom line is we don't know enough yet.
My mom and I enjoy watching some vintage entertainment, including music. Yesterday, we were watching an old Dean Martin special. And I have heard that music has a special way of breaking through to dementia patients.
That's right. There's actually a wonderful documentary. It's called Alive Inside. I'd highly recommend it. I absolutely love it. It's all about music and the impact it can have with people who have Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia, especially in the later stages where people are usually non-communicative. It's hard to know what they're thinking or feeling, but you could put headphones on somebody, play music from, you know, their time when they were young, and you might see them respond, which is really fascinating. And I mean, I think that's a wonderful, it's wonderful to use that, you know, with people who have the disease.
I do think I see that reaction from some people around who are much, much, much farther along. Mm-hmm. So let me end. You used the word hopeful, Erica. Bill Gates said that he's optimistic we can find some kind of treatment that works. Do you share Gates's optimism in, let's say, your lifetime?
Oh, gosh, I hope so. Yeah, absolutely.
You're a young-looking person. But what kind of timeline are we looking at for hope, do you think?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I don't know. I'm hesitant to comment on the timeline, but I think absolutely in my lifetime. I'm really hopeful. Like I said, we learn more and more with every trial. And when you look at other diseases like, you know, HIV, AIDS, cancer even, how those diseases have changed for people who have them because of the amount of money that's been, you know, pushed into research. And, you know, we're getting there. We want Alzheimer's disease research to get there too, whether it's, you know, from the Gates Foundation funding, you know, smaller studies that are innovative or through the Alzheimer's Association. I think research will definitely, more research, more money for it will pave the way to a cure.
That's Erica Farrell, clinical manager at the Washington chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Means that she works with families and caregivers for people with Alzheimer's or progressive dementia. There's a 24-hour helpline the Alzheimer's Association runs. So if you've got questions, your concerns about a loved one, call that helpline, 800-272-3900. Again, 1-800-272-3900. And you don't have to memorize that because we're tweeting that out at KUOW. We're talking on the occasion of Bill Gates saying he's going to give $50 million of his own money to solving the mystery of Alzheimer's and dementia. Erica Farrell, thanks for coming in and telling us what we don't and do know.
Thank you so much.
This is KUOW's The Record. We'll be right back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KUOW. There are four rural Washington counties that flipped last year from voting for Obama to voting for Trump. The Seattle Times went back to one of them to see how people there are reacting to Trump's immigration enforcement. Reporter Nina Shapiro went to Pacific County, home of Long Beach. Nina, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin by telling a story of one Pacific County resident. Who is Mario Rodriguez and what happened to him?
So he was a longtime resident in the Long Beach area. He had worked in bilingual education, and he was just one of those people that everybody in town knew. He worked with a lot of families in school. He would periodically tip off the police chief to trouble spots in town. He volunteered for a lot of nonprofit organizations. He was just really part of the community.
Yeah, part of the community. In fact, the police chief of Long Beach voted for Trump and told you he was shocked when Rodriguez was arrested. Why was he shocked?
So a lot of people in the area, maybe like a lot of people nationally, thought that when Trump, during the campaign, was talking about cracking down on illegal immigration, he was talking about cracking down on the bad guys, as they put it, the criminals, the rapists, as he pointed out, the gang members. They weren't expecting ICE, immigration officials, to come after the people they knew, the people that had lived in their community for 10, sometimes 20 years, the people that were key employees of the industries there, especially the shellfish industry, which this area really depends upon.
And did ICE, the Federal Immigration Agency, did they tell you what, if any, record Mario Rodriguez had?
No. ICE does not typically give out a lot of information about its activities, and that's actually one of the issues for local law enforcement there. So I talked with a sheriff who was really frustrated, and one of his big issues is that ICE won't tell him who they are arresting. And so he has no way of knowing if somebody calls up and says, hey, I haven't seen some neighbors in a while. He doesn't know. Are they missing or have they been arrested and taken to the detention center?
Let's talk about scale, Nina. You report that we know of 28 federal immigration arrests this year in Pacific County. The Obama administration arrested people at a much faster rate. So why is this shocking?
Yeah, I think for a few reasons. I think in Pacific County, in spite of the fact that immigration enforcement was so aggressive in the Obama years, it wasn't aggressive in Pacific County. So this feels new to people. But I would say nationally, so immigration enforcement was very, very aggressive in President Obama's early years as he tried to forge some kind of comprehensive immigration reform effort, which never happened, obviously. Then in his later part of his second term, he adopted new policies. And those new policies were a radical departure from the kind of enforcement that had been happening. So what he said was, immigration officials, I want you now to only focus on certain types of immigrants that are illegally here. And those types were largely people that had criminal convictions. Now, President Trump, when he came into office his first week, he signed an executive order negating all that and listing new priorities. And those priorities were much broader than under President Obama. And they also said, you know, here's who I want you to focus on. And by the way, we're going to take anybody else we want to take as well.
So of these 28 federal immigration arrests in Pacific County, you talked about how ICE keeps its information to itself. So do the people of Pacific County have any sense of any criminal wrongdoing on the part of these 28 people who have disappeared from their community?
No, it doesn't seem like anybody knows of any criminal activity of these folks. I will say that some of the people I've talked to themselves or their spouses or family members will say that the people taken had had a previous deportation order And so that might mean, say somebody was arrested at the border and sent back. So as part of an order like that, you are forbidden from coming back into the country, often for many years. But these people came back anyway. Sometimes, as someone in the story did, came back the very next day. So those are people that are already in the system, and they're much easier for ICE to track down. And those people are part of the enforcement priorities under President Trump.
I don't remember her last name, but I remember Gladys, the woman you're talking
Gladys,
about, who
came
back immediately. And her boyfriend sort of saw the crackdown coming, I think. But you do a nice job painting the ripple effect, how it's not just the detainee, but especially in a small town in Pacific County, it's felt by the community.
Yeah, and that's what was so interesting to me, is it wasn't just these families, but it was the employers who depended on their workers. Sometimes these people had worked for a company for like 20 years, literally 20 or 25 years. There was someone who I interviewed, who was the head of the crew for this company. So employers were feeling that loss and sometimes had to cut back on orders. And then there were people there were school kids who were missing their friends. So it's not just the person that's taken and deported. It's also, sometimes that person's family follows them back to Mexico. So I talked to one 10-year-old boy who was missing his best friend who he had known since kindergarten, because that little boy went back to join his father. And by the way, that's an American citizen. So there are American citizens that are now returning to Mexico or whatever, wherever, to join their parents who have been deported.
Well, again, 28 federal immigration arrests this year in Pacific County. How big an effect can that have on on the cranberry industry, the shellfish industry, in even a small town? Like, is this really an industry issue or more of a person-to-person issue?
I think that's a good question. I think it does have an impact to lose these key employees. I think what I was also hearing was that other people are not coming, or they've moved out of the area for fear of ICE enforcement. And then I think there's the more nebulous quality of it's just created this climate of fear, sometimes blending into paranoia. I talked to one employer who said it's like a storm. It's like, ICE will come in one minute and take someone and they're gone and there's no warning. So there's just this sense like someone could disappear at any moment.
And here's a big question, I think, Nina, is how many Pacific County residents did you meet who said, I voted for Trump and I wouldn't do it again because of what I now realize when it comes to immigration enforcement?
I know that's a big question for a lot of people, particularly Trump's opponents.
The headline in the story was something about how this Washington County was shaken, and it is one of a few counties that flipped from Obama to Trump. So I think a lot of readers are wondering.
A lot of readers, I know, and I know. I don't think people are saying, now I won't vote for Trump, or, this has changed everything I thought. But it has gotten them to rethink at least the way immigration enforcement works. And it's really interesting now, just wandering around talking to people. Everybody now seems to know a lot about immigration enforcement, like more than, I would have known as a reporter a number of years ago. I mean, they know like how long it takes to get a court date after you're released on bond and how much a lawyer costs and how complex the system is. And, there's a kind of a familiarity with how difficult and how not transparent this system is. So I don't know that they're rethinking their whole political worldview, but I think they're trying to figure out what's going on here and trying to wrap their heads around it.
trying to wrap our heads around this presidency, in this case regarding immigration enforcement in a quiet Washington state beachside county. That's reporter Nina Shapiro, who reported from Pacific County, home of Long Beach. Nina, for the Seattle Times, in case I didn't mention. Nina, thanks for coming and telling us about your reporting. Let's do it again, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be right back. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Well, the Seahawks beat Arizona on Thursday night, but it was hard to watch. 11 players injured, including the Seahawks star cornerback Richard Sherman, who's out for the season, ruptured Achilles. If you're interested in Roman history, we're tweeting out a link right now to the origins of the phrase Pyrrhic victory, because it fits. And this is another blow to the Seahawks. The NFL's, well, potentially, NFL is looking into whether the team violated the league's concussion policy when it let Russell Wilson right back into the game after taking a big hit.
Well, I got smacked in the jaw pretty good there. So I wasn't concussed or anything like that.
Russ wasn't concussed, he says. Now let's talk about the game, the injuries, the fallout. We've got back with us the Seahawks reporter for the Seattle PI, Michael Sean Dugar. Good to see you again. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, let's begin with Russell Wilson. So he gets briefly knocked out of this Thursday night game. Referee thinks he might need to be evaluated for a head injury. Wilson leaves the field, ducks into this little tent on the sidelines, and he's back in the game after one play. Is that official NFL policy for dealing with possible concussions? 2 seconds in a little tent?
No, not as much as the time is not the policy. It's the fact that you need to be cleared by a medical professional before you go back into the game. That's the part that they're looking into. And as you can see, this is one of those examples of the broadcast just did him no favors. It just did Russell Wilson zero favors because I think it was NBC, all they just kept showing was Russell goes into the tent, the Chamber of Secrets.
Chamber of Secrets, yeah.
I like calling it of Secrets, I do. He just went in there, sits down, before they can even close the tent on him, he hops right back up, and he's back in after a play.
But why couldn't that be a thumbs up from a doctor, just look into his clear eyes or something?
It looks like he doesn't even talk to anyone.
I'm not a medical professional, by the way. I'm
not either. Yeah. I don't think Russell is either, but he diagnosed himself pretty well there, that he wasn't concussed. It's fun. That's a funny bite right there that we played.
Yeah,
he was going to say I was concussed.
Yes,
right?
Yes. But seriously, why couldn't that be? Why couldn't that thumbs up have come happen right away? Like, what's the problem? Isn't that what the doctor's in the tent for?
What's supposed to happen is a series of tests, which he says he actually went through.
Okay.
And that reportedly went through. That happened the next time Arizona had the ball. But why I say the broadcast isn't doing him any favors, because all you have right now is a broadcast showing him sitting in the tent for like 10 seconds, hopping right back out.
Oh.
He says one thing that supposedly happened when the cameras weren't on him, and then now you have this controversy here. Did it happen? Did it not? Does it matter if it happened on the next drive? Because either way, you hopped right back on the field without speaking or getting cleared by anyone. So even if you did get cleared later, does you going on the field right after that or right before that anyway, does that violate it? Now, that's mm-hmm. why there's a lot going on there on top of them losing seemingly every player on the roster to injury on a Thursday night.
Yeah. Can you listen from memory?
Oh, that's fun. Let me try. Okay.
I couldn't. Richard Sherman, I know.
I can try. Let me try. Richard Sherman, Achilles, Frank Clark, thigh, Jaron Reed, hamstring, Shaquille Griffin, shoulder. He came back. Sheldon Richardson left. Don't know what he had, but he came back. CJ Procise, ankle, didn't come back. Michael Wilhoit, calf, didn't come back. Doug Baldwin, groin, finished the game. Cam Chancellor, stinger, finished the game.
That's unbelievable. I was looking for like 11 names, and I would have accepted any of them. But you went well and above and beyond.
I think that's everyone. Someone's gonna like tweet me and let me know that I forgot someone. But I think that's everyone.
That's a real reporter, Michael Sean Dugar, Seahawks reporter for the Seattle PI. So I want to talk about, here we're talking about Russell Wilson and potential brain injury. Just to remind people how serious this actually is, Aaron Hernandez, New England Patriots player, was convicted of murder, hanged himself in prison. 27 years old. Scientists looked at his brain and decided he had the worst case of this brain disease, CTE, documented in somebody his age. But he only had one reported concussion from his time in the NFL. What do you think that tells us about the official concussion protocols?
Well, football, just how it's constructed, it benefits the player to be dishonest about injury, no matter what it is, whether it's your foot, whether it's your head, just because of how replaceable they are. And the NFL does not have a solution for that. You know, they don't have a solution for the guy who, you know, can't see in front of him farther than his hand in his face, right? But who's going to tell the doctor or tell the coach, hey, I'm fine, right?
But couldn't they just sit out and heal and then they're still on the team, right? Why is it so bad for the player to admit the injury?
It's just the replaceable nature, you know. Uh-huh. There's so many examples to point to, and all it takes is that one play, and then your whole career, whether you bounce back from it, like in Alex Smith, who was injured when he played for the San Francisco 49ers. Colin Kaepernick comes in. Oh, Colin Kaepernick's the superstar. Ship Alex out of town. Mm. You know, Drew Bledsoe goes down. Tom Brady comes in. Tom Brady's the superstar. Okay, Drew, now you go figure it out.
So does that mean Richard Sherman's whole career is in jeopardy now?
It's not that it could be, but it's that I think Richard Sherman's a great example of this too, right? I thought this was like fascinating when he was talking after the game. He said things like, yeah, I got hurt October 8th. Someone's like, oh, well, you know, if you knew it was going to rupture eventually, you were playing tentatively knowing that you were going to get hurt. If you cut on it or planted on it too hard, if you knew that, why were you still out there? And he's like, well, every game matters. I'm out there for my guys. And that's what football has created, that we will applaud, you know, going out there despite knowing that your foot could tear.
Yeah.
If you do a normal football, it's not like he was cautioning himself from doing extra moves. He was just regular planting and going and sprinting. He was preventing himself from doing that on certain plays because he knew his foot would tear.
Should we feel guilty being fans of a game where we know this is versions of this are happening in any week to week? I didn't know that Richard Sherman was hurt, but you can kind of figure, yeah, that's probably the case for other players.
I don't want to tell people what they should feel guilty about, but we should recognize that football primitive.
Primitive.
Yeah, yeah. Like it really is at its core. I tell people this all the time. It's just the biggest, strongest, fastest dudes we can find running into each other for a few hours while we drink Coors Light. You know, that's what it is.
Well, wait a minute. I mean, aren't you? You're looking at complicated offenses and defensive. I mean, should fans give ourselves a little more credit for enjoying what makes football a beautiful thing besides being Smash Mouth?
I don't think as an audience, probably not. No, we love that. The highlights are not of like offensive line play and things like that. There are the football junkies who enjoy that, but it's the monster hits. It's the touchdown celebrations.
Yeah.
That's what turns you into a superstar, other than that, or like being a loudmouth.
Well, what about just Thursday nights? I've been reading about how, like, the Seahawks star Doug Baldwin said, you play on a Sunday, and then when I grew up, it was Sundays. But you play, and maybe Monday Night Football, but now you play on a Sunday, you might play again on Thursday Night Football, as happened to Seattle. He thought that should be illegal. What is the, for those who don't know, what's the problem with Thursday versus Sunday?
Well, the problem is that if you ask a football player after a Sunday game, it's like, hey, how long is it going to take your body to be ready to play again? Depending on his age, he'll probably say about Thursday. The older guys like Dwayne Brown, or I think we asked Dwight Freeney, the Seahawks signed. He's 37. We asked Dwight Freeney that. He said Thursday, and he's like, actually, you know what? Friday. Like it takes that long just to be ready to play again. And so for the guys who have to be asked to play, what's that? 4 days after. Mm-hmm. You know, it's brutal on them in a sport where guys are already banged up all the time.
I was gonna say, it sounds like it takes longer than a week. We just talked about Richard Sherman. Like they're not even healing as it is if they play week to week.
No, you're not. There's no such thing as healthy after probably week one.
Yeah,
because
right.
it's just so violent. It's just even a routine play. Even if you're just out there for a bunch of snaps, you're still just running around. Even in like the Seahawks played in Tennessee, I think week three. It's hot. Now you're just running out there and you're just in the sun for a while. You don't have to hit anybody. That'll wear on you, you know? And then that was a cross-country flight, you know? So football, no, there's no such thing as like healthy. And you'll hear a player say that too, and it's just like, hey, how are you feeling? Are you 100% right now? And they'll like chuckle, or like, I mean, no, dude, of course not. I play football.
Yes.
You know? Like if you're a linebacker, or let's say if you're on the offensive or defensive line, you hit somebody every play. Somebody hits you. Somebody big too, for the most part. That hurts. If you do that every week against big, strong, fast dudes, you're going to hurt every week, but you can't afford, almost literally, like in terms of the financial part of it, to be hurt. You know, they will just throw you on injured reserve, sign a guy, and then you're forgotten until, you know, they'll keep up with your progress, but they got to keep going. The world doesn't stop when you tear something or break something.
Michael Sean, when are you going to stop? When are you going to refuse to cover this game anymore?
When I can afford to.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Finally, do you think that Thursday night football is going to go away anytime soon, or somehow could they change it so that a team like the Seahawks don't get just have their roster decimated?
Well, first part of that, no. Thursday night football is probably not going anywhere. Yeah. The NFL is a billion-dollar corporation, right? So the way they get there is by giving people what they want, which is more. Right, and making money off of more. You know, Thursday Night Football makes a lot of money. You don't become a billion-dollar organization by taking money off of the table.
Uh-huh.
Now, can they do something about it? Yeah, there's a few hypotheses out there that you can add to the schedule, make it 18 weeks, give each team two bye weeks instead of one. You can make it so that if you do play on a Thursday, you are a team coming off of a bye the previous week, so you play on my math's hard.
Yeah.
11 days rest,
yes.
I think, as opposed
instead
to four.
Instead of five or whatever, four.
Yeah, so there are solutions, but in terms of just nixing it all together, you know, Doug Baldwin can call it illegal all he wants, or Sherman can call it a poop fest, like he called it last year. I thought that was a great line, by the way, poop fest.
He called it poop fest.
Yeah, Richard okay. Sherman called it a poop. This last year,
uh-huh.
actually, called it a poop fest.
Oh.
They can do that all they want, but the reality is there's just too much money in it. Now, there's some people make the arguments that the players want it abolished, but you know they get some of the money. The owners aren't signing these huge. The league isn't signing these huge Thursday Night Football deals to give the players more money.
Yeah, that's a bunch of poop.
Let's be yeah.
All right,
let's be honest about that right there. They're like Thursday Night Football is here to stay.
All right, just think how rested the Seahawks are going to be for their next game.
Like, and hopefully
be two extra days. And hopefully healthy. Michael Sean Dugar, Seahawks reporter for the Seattle PI. Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
And we're tweeting out a link to Michael Sean Dugar's stories on the Hawks right now. You can read it yourself at KUOW. It's The Record, back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke, and the list keeps growing. Powerful men, executives, directors, actors, accused of sexually assaulting or abusing coworkers. Last week, the New York Times told the story of five women accusing comedian Louis C.K. of sexual misconduct. Since then, the FX network has cut ties with him, so has HBO. And Louis C.K.'s new film, I Love You, Daddy, is not even going to be released. Locally, gatekeepers for arts organizations are asking themselves, when do we cut ties with national artists accused of assault? Do we continue to showcase their work? Well, let's talk about that right now. Dominique Cantwell heads the Bainbridge Performing Arts Center. They decided not to put on a Woody Allen musical. Allen's stepdaughter accused him of sexually abusing her when she was a child. Dominique, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Warren Etheridge curates the Walla Walla Movie Crush Festival. He was a programmer for the Seattle International Film Festival. Good to see you again, Warren.
Nice to see you, Bill.
So, Dominique, you and your team made this decision last month to not stage a Woody Allen musical, Bullets Over Broadway. It was supposed to end your 2017-2018 season. Woody Allen was accused of abusing his 7-year-old daughter, Dylan Farrow. Back in the early 90s, he repeated those. After Harvey Weinstein was accused of sexual harassment, Allen called it a witch hunt. How did you come to the decision to do the play and then not do the play?
Well, when we had the conversation about programming a year ago, the conversation was carried by a cognitive dissonance that I think exists just about everywhere. but particularly, I think, in arts and politics, and it allowed us to divorce the piece from Woody Allen and his purported behavior. But over the course of the last year...
What do you mean? Will you spell out what you mean by that? How did cognitive dissonance allow you to divorce what you knew from putting on a Woody Allen play?
You know, this is something that is really pervasive in the arts. You know, separating the art and the artist and appreciating the piece, in this case, Bullets Over Broadway, separate from the actions of its creator and letting the art stand on its own. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly part of an ongoing conversation, but that was really sparked over the course of the last year as more and more women have been taking enormous risks to expose a system that's normalized their abuse. And our team realized that we had a part in perpetuating it.
Yeah, and you decided it stops with you in the case of this Woody Allen play. Warren Etheridge, what do you... First of all, I'd like to talk to you, too, but any reaction to the decision not to produce Bullets Over Broadway?
I think it's a great decision. I think the bigger question is why it was part of the lineup to begin with. What is the need for Bullets Over Broadway in a theatrical season?
Well, Dominique, you want to answer that?
It's funny because out of the hundreds of responses that we've received, the overwhelming majority have been encouraging, but the loudest voices have actually been those asking us why we had it in the lineup to begin with. I think clearly it's a mistake, but you know, instantaneously people are assailing us for condoning his alleged actions, for not making a stronger statement. You know, even denouncing us by excusing ourselves from a now toxic relationship. And here we are looking around our community, trying to break out of the cycle and suddenly finding ourselves equated with the abusers in several cases. And I think that there's a terrible parallel there. I think on a far more serious scale, certainly, than what we've encountered. You've got people like the state representative in Alabama calling for victims of abuse to be prosecuted for not coming forward sooner because they've allowed a predator to exist. And it shifts the blame in a way that becomes a tremendous obstacle to those who already feel disempowered. So even in the condemnation of the abuser, men like Ed Henry are ensuring a social hierarchy that continues to place primarily women squarely at the bottom. And I think we're trying to send a signal that it's never too late to do the right thing, even if you'll be eviscerated for not having done it sooner.
Warren, you're also making decisions about what films to showcase. Have you ever had a film submitted to a festival you thought, nope, not that one?
Yes.
For a reason like this.
For this, not because of the artist, but because of the way the content was being presented. I was recently watching a short film which purports to be one that is empowering for females. However, it's made by a straight white male, and the content of which seems very exploitative to me. It's women in the role of tough guy men who go into bars and brawl with people and then have indiscriminate sex in glory holes and other things throughout. And in the end, I just felt dirty. It felt like something that should not be out there.
Well, you have said, Warren, that you're more conflicted than you've ever been about boycotting art and artists.
Yes.
What has you so conflicted?
Woody doesn't have me conflicted, but others have me conflicted. I think there's something different about the perpetual perpetrator of crimes and those who have made mistakes. I get nervous when individual accounts tar the entire individual. In addition to my work programming, I also do work teaching storytelling to combat vets and ex-convicts and abuse survivors, and am a survivor myself. And people can make choices earlier in their life, wrong choices, and still lead decent lives after that. So I worry that one act, Dustin Hoffman being a jerk for a night, in my mind, is not the same thing as James Toback being an ass for life.
Yeah, remind me, Dustin Hoffman was accused, that was more of a sexual harassment?
Yes.
Verbal,
not physical.
Okay. Was it one night? Is that I'm having
one
trouble
party.
Keeping my one party?
One accusation that I've heard.
Okay,
I mean, maybe more, but that's all I've heard.
Okay, Dominique, what about that? A mistake and a forgivable mistake, or not? What do you think?
You know, I think we recognize that this can be a really slippery slope, and you have to paint this with a very fine brush and look at these pieces on a case-by-case basis in the context of our time and the work. I mean, people have asked, what about Picasso and Hemingway and Joyce? Should their work be scrubbed from history? And I think that the answer is no. But I think it's marvelous that we can have a meaningful conversation about where to draw the line and that those are happening in the context of art. I mean, every curator and publisher and consumer has to make their own choices, but this is ours. We're saying the line is drawn here and now. And as we program for the future, it's certainly a part of the meaningful conversation we're having about what we do.
Well, here and now with Woody Allen in your case, but where is your Picasso, Hemingway, Dustin Hoffman, Louis C.K.? I mean, how do you decide what art to bring to your audience?
You know, it's part of a conversation that a lot of us have. We are a community organization, and as a nonprofit, we serve our community, and we're looking at the kinds of conversations that are important to facilitate. Certainly, we don't want to stifle discussion or art. It's exactly the opposite. And so we look at what the benefit ratio is. Certainly, we don't know everything about the creators, but we're doing a lot more to educate ourselves. There's a conscious awakening that's happening, and I don't have all of the answers mm-hmm. now. I don't think any of us do. But unless we're willing to have these conversations and to really listen to one another, we never will.
Warren, Louis C.K., what more thoughts about the line, the decision to make?
You know, Edwin Schlossberg said that the skill of writing is to create a context in which other people can think. I don't care what people think. I just want people to think. And so I want to put art out there in the world on behalf of others that causes them to think. What I worry about is there's a problem with the Woody Allens of the world. Do we need another story about an older white man sleeping with a younger woman? I don't think so. We need work that is actually fresh and new. Before we present these voices of old straight white men again, we can look at alternative voices who are putting something out there that is more useful.
Is it about fresh and new, or is it about condemning? I've decided as a curator that I don't like an older man dating a woman of this age, and therefore, separate from a sexual abuse allegation, I'm going to decide that's not in my theater or in my festival.
You know, I grew up loving Woody Allen, and I love the movie Manhattan. I can't go back and watch it again. I don't want to see it again. I think it'll ruin it for me. I spent an hour in a hotel room with Woody Allen, with his publicist there too, don't panic. Mm. It convinced me at that time, nope, can't do it. I think this man is reprehensible through and through.
An hour with Woody Allen with his publicist was reprehensible? What happened?
Just a conversation. I got the sense of somebody who has no sense of remorse and no real care for humanity. And I think artists, by their very nature, have to be people who are curious and compassionate and want to see the betterment of the human race, not those who are willing to tear it down.
By the way, I got a word about Dustin Hoffman. Apparently, this was over 5 weeks with a 17-year-old high school student working as a production assistant on the TV movie Death of a Salesman. So this is Hollywood Reporter has a big story about it. So not just one party, apparently,
okay.
With Dustin Hoffman.
I'll rethink Dustin.
Rethinking. We're rethinking right now art and artist and audience. And we have Dominique Cantwell here, head of the Bainbridge Performing Arts Center. Warren Etheridge founded, curates Walla Walla Movie Crush Festival. Dominique, what next? What have we learned? What kind of artistic moment do you think we're in with revelation after revelation regarding artists?
Well, I think Warren strikes the right tone. I mean, this has the capacity to be really constructive. Instead of just disavowing, one man, you know, we can really step away from an entire practice now and make room for women and marginalized groups to succeed in a space where they've been systematically suppressed. And I think it speaks volumes about the power of the performing arts that it's such an effective vehicle for this kind of dialogue around something that affects just about everyone. I mean, it's sort of the ultimately accessible vessel for this kind of thing. And it always has been back to its roots in Greek satire. So it's exciting that 2,500 years later, it's still serving that purpose.
Well, what about your replacement for Bullets Over Broadway? What are you looking? Is it just going to be any replacement? Or maybe are you going to go at this sexual abuse issue directly?
We are thinking very carefully about this. We've applied for the rights for a performance that I think will address this really beautifully. But until we get that, I can't say. But certainly, yes, we're programming in context now.
And any final thoughts, Warren Etheridge, on this?
You know, Jerry Seinfeld said something recently which I liked. He said, if you knew everything about everyone, you wouldn't like anyone. And and I think that is a concern for us, is that if we looked at any artist or any individual too closely, we may not like what we find. However, that means that we should gauge them by the art itself and what it is actually, how it's actually benefiting us as a society and as an audience.
Mm, good question. How is the art benefiting us, and how do you take the artist into account? Warren Etheridge, founder, curator, Walla Walla Movie Crush Festival. He's been a curator for One Reel Film Festival at Bumbershoot, programmer for Seattle International Film Festival, and Dominique Cantwell, executive director of the Bainbridge Performing Arts Center. She and her team decided not to put on Bullets Over Broadway by Woody Allen. Thanks to both of you for this conversation.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW, made every day for you by Amin Al-Sadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Andel. Packed show tomorrow. Author, religious studies scholar Reza Aslan, cartoonist and novelist G. Willow Wilson, social psychologist Dan Ariely. I'm Bill Radke. Have a fantastic Monday.